alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لا فضيلة كالجهاد ولا جهاد كمجاهدة الهوى.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "There is no greater distinction than jihad, and no jihad like combating one's self."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. Now you're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find a very interesting and profound conversation in the historical texts between a student and a teacher. Now, in this conversation between the student and the teacher, we find that the student is a famous and well-known companion by the name of Jabir al-Jufi, and the teacher is the esteemed, highly respected Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. In this conversation between the two, we find that eternal spiritual wisdoms and commandments full of high moral standards are exchanged. In one of the places we find in this conversation that Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "There is no asceticism like the shortness of hope." Now, asceticism, dear friends, means to refrain from something. And now here, specifically in the Islamic context, it means to refrain from worldly, materialistic desires more than what is appropriate. So for example, Islam does not say become an ascetic, you know, refrain from the world to the extent where you stop eating and you stop drinking and you don't have a family and you don't have children and you don't have a wife and, you know, you don't have a car, you don't have a house, you don't have clothes. No, this is not what Islam says. Islam, of course, is the perfect path, the path, the middle path, the path of moderation. And so, yes, you can have these things, but to what extent? When does it become an extreme? If you can go about with a simple car, why buy a car that costs a house? Right? There are some people who they have cars that cost $200,000-$300,000 or $100,000. So anyways, instead of taking a tangent, asceticism is something which is promoted by Islam, but in moderation. And here, Imam al-Baqir shows a different venue of asceticism. He says that there is no asceticism, there is no refraining from the materialistic world better than the shortness of hope. Now here, of course, you know, we're talking about hopes and desires for materialistic wealth, for the materialistic world, for social status and fame and position and money and power and wealth. The shorter we have hopes in these things, meaning the less we desire these materialistic things, the more ascetic we become. A very short statement, but truly I can continue to speak about it. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time, so I will have to leave you with this and your thoughts. No asceticism is better than the shortness of hope of the materialistic world. Beautiful conversation between Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Now, when we talk about Shia identity, there was a companion of Imam alayhi salam by the name Jabir al-Ju'fi. Jabir al-Ju'fi, he was a companion of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. One day, he was talking to Imam and he was like, I want to know who is a Shia. Can you give me the characteristics, the identities of Shia? Imam alayhi salam then mentioned, Ya Jabir, yaktafi man ittakhadha at-tashayyu' an yaqula bihubbina ahli al-bayt. Is it sufficient for someone who claims to be a Shia to say that I love Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam? Is it sufficient? Then Imam alayhi salam made a statement. He said, Fawallahi, I swear by God, Ma shi'atuna illa man ittaqallah. Indeed, our Shia are those who fear Allah. They have taqwa. Wa ata'ah, and he obeys Allah. Wa ma kanu yu'rafuna illa bitawadu'i wattakhashu'. Shia, our Shia are those who are known by humility and humbleness. These are our Shias. Wa ada'il amana. Our Shias are those who, when you trust them with something, they will be entrusted and they will keep the amana. Wa kathrati dhikrillah. They are known by remembering Allah a lot. Wasawmi, they are known by fasting a lot. Wasalati, they are known by praying a lot. Walbirri bilwalidain, and they are kind to their parents. Wattaahudi liljirani min alfuqara'i wa ahli almaskana walgharimin, and they are good to their neighbors. They help the neighbors who are poor, destitutes, and who needs help. Our Shias, they are known by their help. Wal aitam, they help those who are orphans. Wasidqil hadith, they speak that which is truth. Watilawatil Quran, they read Quran a lot. Wakaffil alsuni anin nasi illa min khair, they don't talk about other people except that which is good.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah. around the world with reporters.
Unemployment rates among Turkish youth have increased dramatically in the recent period, especially after the outbreak of the new coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest figures released by the Turkish Statistical Institute, the unemployment rate was 12.7% in September 2020. Turkish government says reviving economy is among its priorities amid the pandemic. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed not to allow foreign factors negatively affect the country's economy.
It is not possible for a state to survive in long term with rising unemployment. So we have developed various plans to revive our economy, turning it into one of the 10 largest economies in the world by equal distribution of wealth among our population.
As part of efforts to stop declining employment, the government has banned companies from firing employees during the pandemic. So it prevents us from seeing the direct effect of the coronavirus on unemployment. We cannot see it in numbers, but we can definitely see it on the ground. This is how economists explain.
Unemployment is one of the biggest economic problems in the world, and Turkey is no exception. Despite our government's projects to lower the unemployment rates, unfortunately, the numbers are rising, especially amid the pandemic that has paralyzed the economic sector.
The government say it plans to lower the unemployment rate to 10.9% in 2023. However, it seems that it all depends on how the country plans to recover from a pandemic and the lira crisis. As observers say, the main strength point of the ruling party has been flourishing economy and low unemployment. And now, with the pandemic continuing more and more, the country is witnessing the ruling party's popularity sliding further. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
The executive director of Yemen's petroleum company has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a over Saudi Arabia's blockade. The officials say the company lost over $100 million in 2020 due to the Saudi-led coalition violations and siege, and accused the UN of complicity.
The United Nations is providing cover for the Saudi-led coalition's acts of piracy in international waters, and it bears full responsibility for them. The violations are huge, and the fines we have suffered are immense.
The senior official said nearly 24 patrol ships belonging to Yemen's petroleum company were confiscated by Saudi Arabia in 2020. He said the seizures came despite the fact that the ships all had transit permits from the UN. Yemen's petroleum company said the ships were released after a few months, but Saudi Arabia's counter acts of piracy cost him millions of dollars in delay fines.
The United Nations has become a clear partner in this blockade against the Yemeni people and has come to stand by the coalition of aggression, so it bears responsibility for the humanitarian crisis.
The Yemeni officials say the confiscation of ships caused a spike in fuel prices and forced the closure of some services. They also say the delays and lack of fuel pushed the medical sector to collapse and caused a humanitarian crisis. Many people have to wait for days to get fuel for their vehicle and the limited number of petrol stations.
Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen has led to the deaths of Yemeni people and is pushing the country further toward what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has taken place amid the silence of international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washalif, Sana'a.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as the years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it has leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued a policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha, that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's army kicked off a maneuver that put to test hundreds of its domestically built unmanned aerial vehicles. The two-day military exercises saw the use of a variety of surveillance and reconnaissance drones, combat drones, bombers, and loitering munitions, which are known as suicide drones. As part of the drill, the Persian Gulf was simulated as the conflict zone, where the Iranian Army's Navy used the suicide drones to destroy their targets.
All of the four forces of the army took part in the drills by deploying their drones. Each force concentrated on their assigned missions. We at the Navy used a variety of our stealth drones that can fly deep into the enemy's waters and keep a close eye on their activities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's defense industry has been hit by U.S. arms embargoes for four decades. The sanctions have barred Iran from purchasing any foreign weapons, even from its closest allies. However, Iranian officials say the country's defense sector is up and running. The reason is the country has for all these years been developing its own arms based on domestic capabilities. And now, drones are the epitome of Iran's advances in the defense industry.
In the field of UAVs, Iran is neck and neck with the few countries that have the technology. We began by producing surveillance UAVs, but today, our unmanned aircraft can conduct combat missions as well. And we owe this achievement to US sanctions, because they forced us to rely on our domestic resources.
The Islamic Republic stepped into the field of UAV production around 2011 by reverse engineering American and Israeli drones. It electronically commandeered or shot down. Tehran says today it is self-sufficient in designing, producing, and operating a range of UAVs with different applications.
In less than a decade, the term UAV grew from an alien word to a keyword in Iran's airspace. Still, the Iranian army says this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the greater part of Iran's defense capabilities is yet to be publicized.
The Prime Minister made the announcement Monday. The country will be going back to its 2020 mantra, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Boris Johnson warned there were going to be tough weeks ahead, but still offered a ray of hope.
The weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. But I really do believe that we're entering the last phase of the struggle, because with every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favour of the British people. And thanks to the miracle of science, not only is the end in sight, but we know exactly how we will get there.
Some children across England had one day in school before the announcement was made, and people are vexed by yet another last-minute announcement. The opposition says the government is going to make mistakes, but to make the same mistakes again is unacceptable. But Boris Johnson insists the tier system was working and that the new variant of COVID-19 is what derailed it. The Prime Minister's remarks caused hashtags resign, school closures, and Boris has failed the UK to shoot to the top of the country's Twitter trending charts. He is accused of ignoring the science by insisting schools are safe. The third lockdown will be hard for families juggling work and school, but many companies in the leisure, retail and hospitality sectors feel they might not make it through to the spring. In response to these fears, the Chancellor of the Exchequer made an announcement Tuesday.
Well, in order to help support businesses through a difficult period through to the spring, today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help. For businesses in the most affected sectors who are asked to close, they will receive up to £9,000 in a one-off cash grant. It's important to remember that comes on top of the existing monthly grant of £3,000 that those businesses receive, and the extension of furlough all the way through to April. You know, we remain committed to protecting jobs and supporting businesses.
The new COVID-19 restrictions come days after the UK and the EU reached a trade and security agreement as part of their Brexit divorce deal, and businesses in Britain had to start trading differently. They were dreading this, but now they say planning around COVID-19 restrictions has made the extra paperwork surrounding post-Brexit trade pale into insignificance. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Christmas holidays are almost over in Italy. It's been a particularly testing time for many as the country is struggling to recover from the economic slowdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic. A study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that about 4 million Italians have been seeking help, many for the first time, to put food on the table during these Christmas festivities. The association has warned the number of people needing food support has doubled compared to last year.
These figures give a snapshot of what the current economic situation is in Italy. 4 million people had to resort to soup kitchens or food pantries this Christmas due to the anti-COVID restrictions. The situation is rapidly aggravating, with our estimates indicating that this year many more will join the ranks of the poor.
About one-third of all people seeking help in Italy during the pandemic are first-time recipients, charitable groups have warned. In a reversal of usual trends, most are Italians and not foreign residents.
According to Coldiretti, among the new poor in Italy, there are those who have lost their jobs, small traders or artisans who were forced to shut down, people employed in the underground economy who do not enjoy special subsidies or public aid, and have no savings or assets to fall back on.
E quindi diventa sempre più difficile.
The economic crisis caused by the pandemic is wreaking havoc, especially among the middle classes. We weren't expecting this to happen so quickly.
Some have lost their job. Some others work much less compared to pre-COVID times. Some friends of mine couldn't buy presents. Some had to give up many other things. It's really hard for an increasing number of people.
The government is reportedly looking at extending the current restrictions until January 15, meaning that non-essential shops will be closed and bars and restaurants can only do takeaway services during weekends. A major question is whether Italy's high schools will reopen as planned on January 7. Max Civili, Rome.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived, when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
Situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US, and internationally. Because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Kabella, London.
The
Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
It's very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. He is also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against the Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, Deputy Head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kanu.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. Thank you.
اگه انسان بیفته دنبال این مسائل، دنبال فزون طلبی، هیچی قانع نمیشی. همینطوری
Human beings are not easily satisfied in terms of material things, and extravagance has no end. This type of life puts pressure on both the people and society. All classes of a society, from a shopkeeper to a clergyman, must know that extravagance and overexpenditure will damage our lives, especially when we want to help others. If divinity and remembrance of Allah does not exist in our life, then we might face some problems. For instance, I, as a clergyman, cannot explain the religious matters exactly to the people, or I take the position of the people who are more qualified than me. All these deviations and miserliness are all rooted in forgetting the remembrance of Allah. The emphasis on remembrance of Allah in the Quran is because the righteousness of people does exist in this action. If we remember Allah frequently, we can do our obligations in the best way possible, leave our unlawful actions, and help the people around us. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Khalal Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Khalal Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
European distrust of American motives was behind the EU leaders' recent signing of a comprehensive agreement on investment with China over the urgent objections of the Donald Trump administration and Joe Biden's transition team. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Asia Times website. This article is published under the heading Two-Faced U.S. Trade Policy Erodes Atlantic Alliance. Stay tuned for the details, please. European distrust of American motives was behind the EU leaders' recent signing of a comprehensive agreement on investment with China over the urgent objections of the Donald Trump administration and Joe Biden's transition team. Washington's restrictions on trade and investment with China Europeans believe, provide pretexts for dodgy deals that favor U.S. companies at the expense of competitors on the other side of the Atlantic. The Trump administration, of course, has long been in a trade war with Beijing, and there have been numerous news reports that Biden's advisors had let European officials know they hoped for a delay that would give the new administration time to chime in before finalization of the pact. Matt Pottinger, deputy national security advisor to Trump, issued a statement saying leaders in both U.S. political parties and across the U.S. government are perplexed and stunned that the EU is moving towards a new investment treaty right on the eve of a new U.S. administration. Europe has ignored the pressure because Washington isn't fighting a war, but rather is talking war while American companies work out their side deals with China. One cause of European rancor, the Financial Times reported on December 24th, is that U.S. authorities grant exceptions to American companies trading with China while denying them to Europeans. European tech executives and diplomats are accusing the U.S. of using its sanctions regime to shut them out of the Chinese market while offering exemptions for American companies, the newspaper reported. Over the past 2 years, the U.S. has imposed aggressive sanctions on Chinese companies such as Huawei and, as of Friday, the chipmaker SMIC, which have prevented them from buying most U.S.-made technologies. The Financial Times quoted an unnamed European senior executive as saying the sanctions had created an America First trade policy. So far, U.S. companies have been given licenses to supply Huawei, while European suppliers cannot. Many European businesses that produce chips and chip-making equipment are affected by American sanctions because they rely on U.S. intellectual property. A second European tech executive complained of having once been stopped from supplying components to Chinese buyers because of suspicions that they could be used for military purposes, but the market for the components was quickly filled by U.S. vendors selling through middlemen. Trade restrictions always provide opportunities for special treatment of politically connected, regardless of which party is in power, as the Wall Street Journal observed in a December 28 editorial. As Mr. Trump's tariffs began to bite, Congress sent hundreds of letters to the U.S. Special Trade Representative supporting specific tariff exclusions. Despite U.S. sanctions, there is no shortage of computer chips in China, which expects to install 10 million 5G base stations by 2024. Huawei has limited access to the top-of-the-line chips that power high-end smartphones, with transistor gate width of 7 nanometers or less, but it doesn't need them for its mobile broadband infrastructure. The U.S. sanctions have nuisance value for Huawei, but haven't stopped the Chinese broadband juggernaut. Sales of American chip design and testing software to Chinese customers boomed during 2020, as there are reports in December 24th analysis, the tech war that isn't. Cadence, one of the top three American firms, doubled its Chinese sales during the third quarter. Although The Commerce Department banned sales to Huawei's high silicon chip design subsidiary. Chinese startups, staffed by former top engineers for the American design firms, and in some cases funded by the American firms, have hired Huawei engineers to produce the same designs under a different corporate logo. China is the world's biggest market for chip design, and American firms can't maintain their lead without selling to China. No American firm manufactures telecom infrastructure. The Trump administration declined to mobilize American resources to create a competitor to Huawei and also refused to put money behind the number two telecom equipment maker, Sweden's Ericsson. The Trump administration wasn't offering any such incentives, a fatal mistake. Given the cold shoulder by Cisco, Kudlow then started listening to the software industry, which claimed that fancy coding could turn generic computer components into an alternative to Huawei. He enthused to Wall Street Journal, Dell and Microsoft are now moving very rapidly to develop software and code capabilities that will in fact replace a lot of the equipment. To quote Michael Dell, software is eating the hardware in 5G. To a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And to software companies, the solution to every problem looks like a million lines of code, especially if the federal government provides $1 billion subsidy. That is what the Software Industry Coalition, the Open Radio Access Network, is demanding from the federal government. It's one of the worst ideas to pass muster in American industry since New Coke, as Cressel explained. No one knows if it will work. Software might substitute for the sophisticated custom chips that filter out the signal from the noise in ultra-high-speed 5G transmissions, but they might not. It will take about 5 years to find out, according to industry experts, and the debugging and testing of billions of lines of code probably would take another 2 years. Network security has been the Trump administration's stated concern about Huawei 5G networks, but an open access system with thousands of access points offers countless opportunities for malign actors. Worst of all, the software solution only handles the routing of information once it is transmitted from a base station to a central network. The 5G applications for the Internet of Things, including autonomous vehicles and self-programming industrial robots, require greater computing power in the base station itself to allow the 5G network to communicate with client machines. There are a couple of small-scale test projects for O-RAN approach in Europe, but European telecom experts view the software-based solution as another feckless American welfare program for the world's richest tech companies. That's why Europe in November put forward its own declaration of independence from American semiconductor technology. In early December, the EU agreed on a European initiative on processors and semiconductor technologies, committing about $30 billion of the European Recovery and Resilience Facility funds to digital sovereignty. As Thierry Breton, the EU Commissioner for Internal Market, put it, Europe has all it takes to diversify and reduce critical dependencies. A collective approach can help leverage existing strengths and embrace new opportunities as advanced processor chips play an ever more important role for Europe's industrial strategy and digital sovereignty. That, of course, means reducing dependence on U.S. intellectual property. China is, of course, paying close attention. A European diplomat based in China told the Financial Times, "This declaration shows that European governments want to be less dependent on U.S. technology, although that will take a long time. This process was accelerated by the U.S. sanctions. For European companies, China is such a big market that they need to find ways of serving it." That remark was cited in a report on the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment on December 31st on the Chinese political website, guancha.cn.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, sacrificing in establishing deen. A Muslim will face many tests, difficulties, challenges, temptations, and distractions in the path of carrying out his or her responsibilities and establishing deen upon this earth. Only the one who truly yearns the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala more than anything in the world will be able to sacrifice whatever is required for his or her interests, his or her desires, his or her ambitions and life to fulfill the duty that the Creator has obliged and obligated upon him or her. And that is to carry out the mission of the Prophet as his chosen witness to mankind of establishing the deen of Islam in authority in this world. Now for a Muslim, this is something that is a goal. While he's alive, living on this planet Earth, this establishment of the religion of Islam in his life, in the life of his family, in the life of his relatives, in the lives of people around him, from there to life of his city, from there to life of his province and region and the entire world, establishing deen becomes that goal that every Muslim is expected to strive and struggle for. And this is something that we need to actively work on. And the prerequisite of spreading the deen, the prerequisite of implementing the deen in the outside world is us. We implement deen within ourselves. We implement Islam and practice Islam in our everyday life. And that enables us to be able to work on the rest of the world. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we're talking about sacrificing in the establishment of Deen of Islam. So we said that the goal of a human being, the goal of a Muslim, is to implement Islam. Implement it where? Implement it within himself to begin with, and then start to make its way out. So you implement it upon your children. Of course, you educate them, you help them grow. They need to understand what the importance of Islam is in this life and in the hereafter. You educate them about what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants. And then this circle keeps expanding till, inshallah, we get to the reappearance of Imam Zaman alayhi salam, who is going to implement this very religion on the entire planet Earth. Now, to sacrifice for this cause means to give up that which is dear to us, whether it be our comforts, time, wealth, pleasures, desires, ambitions, or interests. For the sake of what? For the sake of that which our heart yearns more. For example, Ramadan is a great reminder of this concept. For as believers, we leave that which is most fundamental for the human being, food and drink, for nothing other than securing the pleasure of our Lord Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his rewards in Jannah, realizing that this is superior than the enjoyment of the basic pleasures of this world. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala every year takes us through this practice of fasting in Ramadan, and we are asked to give up on even those things which we are, generally speaking, in our everyday life, not ready to give up, drinking and eating. So, brothers and sisters, this is a practice, right? This is a great lesson that Allah is trying to teach us, that you have to be in the mode of sacrificing for Allah and for His deen. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.